argument today is Phillips against Allen. Mr. Crooks.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. We're here today because we believe the District Court should be reversed for granting summary judgment to the defendants based on the District Court's belief that there was probable cause premised on Ruby, one of the victims of a robbery and a shooting, her identification of Weidrich as the perpetrator. Now, it's conceded by everyone that normally an identification by a victim or a credible witness is sufficient for probable cause, but not always, and certainly not in the circumstances here. This court said in Beaucamp that if the circumstances of an ID would lead a reasonable officer to be suspicious, he has the duty to further investigate.
So let me ask you, Mr. Crooks, it seems I recall that, I have two questions for you. First of all, who are you proceeding against right now? The only person I see really discussed is Allen. Are you still complaining about anybody else?
Judge, the other individuals played a role without a question. Commander Herrera, one of the defendants, for example, took a telephone call that contained a tip of someone who could very well have committed this crime.
That has nothing much to do with the ID. I mean, if you're really...
It does not, Your Honor.
Because, I mean, I don't see much other than just Mr. Allen. But my bigger question vis-a-vis what he did is the following. As I understand it, he's also raised a defense of qualified immunity.
Yes, Your Honor.
And probable cause is fairly straightforward. It's an objective test. But if you're in the qualified immunity world, there's even this thing called arguable probable cause. And it seems to me this officer gives the array of photographs. There might be 30 of them. There might be 36. You know, she focuses on one page. She first pauses on one. And he says, "Are you sure?" And then she looks again. She looks at number 5, which is your client, and she says, "This is the guy." And he says again, "Are you sure?" But when he says, "Are you sure?" the first time, she had pages of photographs she could have reviewed. I just don't see the kind of direction and guiding that would have tainted this identification so much that it couldn't be used as probable cause, or at least arguable probable cause.
And, Judge, my response is this. The 30 pages of photographs, and yes, Ruby did say that.
Six photographs per page. I think it's 5 pages, right?
She did say that. No one else has said that. Commander Allen did not say that. I don't believe that that's true. I think we're all surprised by that testimony.
But what if it's just 6 photographs? Does it matter?
Judge, it does matter under the circumstances here. Because what we have here is a woman that her and her mother both stated after the crime, they gave a general description of the person that committed it. There was no indication they knew this person or that this person was even familiar to them. That next day, Commander Allen goes to the hospital, and in the presence of Ruby and Elizabeth, he questions a witness, and I'll put quotation marks around witness, because what this so-called witness said is he put forth triple hearsay. He said Richard, who is Ruby's brother, Elizabeth's son, Richard says that Devante, someone he knows on the street, said that Weidrich said that he'd committed an armed robbery at the very same currency exchange where Ruby had been that night before the robbery. So the name of a person, familiar person who lived down the street from Ruby and Elizabeth, a person that Ruby later admitted she knew him from the neighborhood and watched him grow up, a person that Elizabeth had known all his life.
But why does that mean it's impossible that she would have thought he was the robber? I mean, you know, we're focusing on this photo thing. Okay, if his name has come up his name has come up, but I don't see why the police officer should have been so alert as to think that her identification wasn't a genuine identification that he could move forward with. I mean, true. I mean, there are other things, and he's exonerated in his, you know, at least he's not found guilty in his criminal proceeding. But that's not the standard for probable cause.
Clearly not, Your Honor. But to answer your question, the reason he should have been alerted is because he knew, and we're looking at an objective officer knowing what Allen knows. Allen knew that he deliberately made this suggestion. And then a person identifies someone who they've known and lived near as this person grew up.
Well, it's
a person,
Bufkin, who tells Allen. Allen isn't making the suggestion. Bufkin is the one, the boyfriend, is the one who gives this A said to B, said to C, said to somebody else.
Correct. But it's Allen that's eliciting these statements. And it's our contention that if you look at everything Allen did in this case, from the lies he told to the assistant state's attorney who was doing felony review.
After the arrest.
It's after the arrest, but it shows that he was doing exactly what we claim he was doing, that he was intent on framing Wydrick Phillips.
But you haven't given us any reason why he would have Wydrick Phillips in his sights as opposed to anybody else random in Bellwood.
Your Honor, Wydrick Phillips fell into his sights because he wanted to solve the crime, and Mr. Bufkin gave him a basis to do that. Allen knew that Ruby suspected that her brother Richard was involved in this crime because she had a lot of money on her, a lot of cash. She had cashed a lot of checks, and he would have known that. It made sense to her that he would bring in someone else to do the robbery. So Allen knew that she was predisposed to accept that kind of a suggestion. And let's look at this from what happened with Elizabeth, because we can see for sure that the suggestion worked there. When he went to the hospital and he went to show photos to Elizabeth, Elizabeth said, "Don't show me photos." She testified that it was too black to identify anyone. She told Allen she couldn't identify anyone. He nevertheless insisted that she look at the photographs. He told her, the person that shot you is in these photos, and Ruby has identified that person.
So after she identified him, what should the police have done?
Well, the police should do what Gazelle versus Hiller says. If there's reason to believe that there's something fishy about the identification, you investigate further. And that would have been the perfect thing to do here, because had they investigated further, they would have found out.
That means you're leaving the person who's been identified by the victim. You're letting him roam around, right? No, not arresting him, even though the victim fingered him. That's a problem, isn't it?
No, I don't see that as a problem, Your Honor,
well,
but then I know he's not guilty.
People. I mean, the victim says this person robbed me and... Shot me. And you're saying, well, we're going to do some more investigation before we arrest him, right? That's a difficult trade-off.
And, Judge, that's what the law says we have to do. On the one hand, you can talk...
There's a trade-off. Right?
There is a trade-off,
Judge.
The victim
has identified someone as having shot her. That's very serious. You have the victim identification, and on the other hand, of course, should be suspicious and you're uncertain and so on. Well, I think that's a difficult choice for police to make in that situation.
And, Judge, as soon as Wydrick's mother was aware that he was under arrest, she brought the Federal Express manifest to the police station, which showed that he was with her delivering and picking up Federal Express packages that day and could not possibly have gotten back.
Now you're not challenging the arrest. You're saying he was detained too long.
No, Judge, I am not. The reason I bring that up is you said, what should they have done? And what I'm saying is they would have
mentioned something they should have done after they arrested him. That implies the arrest was okay, but they detained him too long.
The point, Your Honor, is that...
Well, isn't
had,
that what you were saying?
No, Your Honor, it was not. That's what happened because they did arrest him. Had they not arrested him, they could have been provided with that manifest from Federal Express in very short order. They would have had the evidence that he had a lack of an alibi. And I think the broader picture is all of these questions approach
you're assuming, of course, that everybody who takes evidence to the police is taking only truthful evidence, that nobody would ever say, fake such a document by using photocopying with selective erasures before the copying. And that life isn't nearly as simple as you imply. Documents' authenticity may be questionable, needs to be checked. And one could say there's almost an infinite regress of things people can do before an arrest. But we so far have, I think, been pretty insistent on saying that eyewitness identification is enough for an arrest and the checking can come later.
You still have your state malicious prosecution. I mean, the district court dismissed without prejudice your state claims. So, I mean, it's just sounding to me, listening to you, that the arrest was based on the eyewitness identification, even with the prior mention of his name. We have the Neal versus Biggers factors. We've got all these other things. Keeping him longer may well have been a state law violation. There may have been enough coming to their attention that they should have been more aggressive looking at it. But as I understand it, you have the ability to pursue that in the state courts.
We do have that ability, but we also have our federal claims. And the questioning here, I think, is premised on this idea that Allen was in a tough spot. And if you look at all the things that Allen did when he lied to the assistant state's attorney for felony review, indicating that they had the coat that the video says was used and worn by the assailant, when in fact Ruby said that's not the coat. It doesn't look anything like the coat. He then told her, I can't show you the coat because it's locked up in the evidence room. In fact, he had a key to the evidence room. When we look at that, we know that Allen was thinking just what I'm describing to you. He knew he set this up. He knew he provided that information to make that ID so that a woman who said through omission, I don't know the person that did this to me, and then a day later identified someone she had known all of his life. In between those two acts is the suggestion with the Bufkin interview in the hospital that Wydrick Phillips was the person. Allen knew what was going on. He knew what he had done. And that's what we go by. What does he know? He knew he had set this up. I can see I'm into my rebuttal time. I'll reserve the rest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Victor.
May it please the Court. The district court properly held that defendants had probable cause to make this arrest because one reliable victim identification, it's all that's required under the law.
And I guess Mr. Crooks's point is, why is it reliable if Ruby herself claims not to know the person, but then she picks a face out of the lineup of somebody who, in fact, it turns out she really knows, whether she knows him by a nickname, whether she knows him by his birth certificate name or any other name. It's a face she knows.
Your Honor,
why is she lying about that?
She's not lying about her identification. That's according to the undisputed material facts.
She says that she doesn't know this man. When Commander Allen says to her, that's Wydrick Phillips, I mean, she says she doesn't know the person.
Right, and she was actually consistent with her previous descriptions to the police officers. When she gave those descriptions, she never indicated that she knew the person.
Aren't there people that you know the face, but you may not know the name? Would you actually say, I don't know that person?
Well, the important information, Your Honor...
No, really. If you know the face and not the name, would you say, I know nothing about this person? Would you say, oh, no, I met him, you know, at some point, but I don't remember his name?
Ruby may have known that person, but...
But she told the police officer she didn't, but then she says she did.
Right, and that's the important test, Your Honor, is the information that's coming to Commander Allen, and then by virtue of that, that's the information that the reasonable, prudent person knows. So Commander Allen, after Ruby said, that's him, he didn't stop there. He vetted her credibility. He said, do you know that person? She said, no. Again, he didn't stop. He's testing her credibility. One credible witness is enough. He takes it a step further. He says, that's Wydrick Phillips. Remember, there's this hospital interview. There's a chance that Ruby had overheard the name Wydrick, so he's checking that. Based on the information he's getting, she doesn't know the person. And that's the only information that matters, Your Honor. That's the test. Plaintiff is contending that the test is what Commander Allen knew, but it's really the test that a reasonable, prudent person knows. And that's where plaintiff gets mixed up. Their essential argument on appeal is that a reasonable, prudent person could not have believed Ruby's identification because that person would know that what Commander Allen did was intentional. That's flawed for two reasons. First, he misinterprets what the reasonable, prudent person knows. It's not Commander Allen's intentions. And second, he misinterprets the other part of the standard. That's whether there's a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification.
But now, the problem is these Neal versus Biggers factors are based on mythology, at least according to decent studies of eyewitness identification, the idea that you're going to memorize the face of the person who's in the middle of shooting your mother and shooting you turns out actually not really to be true. And so there's a lot of squishiness here in this situation where we rely on these things for arrests and there may just be nothing, there's no there.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court set forth these factors.
I know they did, and I think they may be interested at some point in revisiting them because some of them just don't check out, if you will.
No, Your Honor. To paraphrase Chief Judge Easterbrook in Bell versus Irwin, it's a 2003 case. That case held that where there's enough undisputed material facts to justify an officer's conduct objectively, there would be nothing left for a jury to do.
No, you're not engaging with Judge Wood's question, which is that the factors listed in Neal against Biggers appear to be urban legends. They have nothing to do with the actual reliability of testimony and of identification. They've been tested by psychologists in the intervening 30-some-odd years, and they've all been found to be false. The Supreme Court is hearing a case this fall, I think just heard it, in which we may get a revision of this subject. Now, obviously, we don't apply the Supreme Court's cases tomorrow to this case, but one of the problems that's posed here is that trying to extend Neal against Biggers to civil litigation may be doing exactly the wrong thing.
No, Your Honor, it's not the wrong thing, because this provides the police officers with a way to not only conduct their investigation, but also safeguard the person from wrongful accusations.
And that's and I think actually what you want to say is that Commander Allen, back in 2005, had no way of knowing that in 2011 the Supreme Court was going to be rethinking Neal versus Biggers, and so he was entitled to, this is what I'm imagining the argument that you would want to make, he was entitled to rely on the eyewitness testimony as he gathered it.
That's right, Your Honor. The law at the time... That's right, Your Honor. The law at the time was one reliable witness is enough, and your question also addresses the defendant's qualified immunity defense. The standard for qualified immunity is whether a reasonable officer in the position of Commander Allen under those same circumstances, would that officer believe that he or she had probable cause. The well-established law at the time was one reliable witness was enough, and that's what the law Commander Allen was operating on. Plaintiff has failed to cite to a single case that stands for the proposition that what Commander Allen did here, which was interview a source of information in the general vicinity of a victim, that was unduly suggestive, or that if that happens, the police officers cannot rely on any subsequent identification. That rule wasn't in place at the time that Commander Allen acted. And in fact, it would be an untenable rule. I mean, how would police officers be able to enforce a rule? Would they have to make sure that the victim is outside the building, miles away, that the victim was sequestered so that the victim couldn't hear? It's a rule that's not tenable, and to the extent that rule can be construed, Commander Allen didn't have the benefit of that rule.
So what's your response to the other question I asked about who else is actually in this case as a defendant other than Commander Allen? You're indicating that you're representing the whole group, including the village.
Yes, Your Honor, I am representing the whole group. Our position, it's set forth in our brief, is that all the other individual defendant officers had no personal involvement in either the hospital interview with Bufkin or the first photographic array. And that's what plaintiff is conceding they're focusing on.
Therefore, and that's what built up to the probable cause, and if there's probable cause, then that's it.
That's right, Your Honor. If there's probable cause, that's it. But moving back to the first prong, which is whether there was an unduly suggestive lineup in the first place. Plaintiff's argument is that there was this intentional conduct by Commander Allen. There's not even evidence of that. The United States Supreme Court in Devin Peck versus Alford held that, to be clear, subjective intentions are completely irrelevant in the first place, but if you want to determine what those are, it's by objective means. The plaintiff doesn't even have that. What happened in the interview? There's not even evidence that Commander Allen knew the name Weidrich going into it, or that he knew that Bufkin was going to be there, or what Bufkin was going to say. He's not the one that said Bufkin. So plaintiff's argument is flawed, but he doesn't even have evidence of his flawed argument. Subjective intentions, though, to be clear, are not relevant. On page 154 of Devin Peck, the court held that subjective intentions can never be a valid basis for invalidating an arrest. That's plaintiff's theory here, is that Commander Allen acted intentionally, therefore the lineup was not valid. That's not a valid basis for the arrest. That's the United States Supreme Court. The district court understood this distinction. Page 954, the district court said, yes, at the time of the first photographic array, construing the facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiff.
954? I didn't think the district court's opinion was quite that long.
That's the reported decision, Your Honor.
Oh, it fed sup rather than the district court's actual. Okay.
But the district court, it said, yes, we must construe the facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. Yes, at the time of the first photographic array, Commander Allen knew that there was a chance Ruby overheard the name Weidrich. However, footnote 10, plaintiff alleges that he was intentionally framed. Whether or not that's true, it doesn't matter, because subjective motivations are irrelevant. So those are the proper facts that a reasonable, prudent person knows, and this is where the second part of the inquiry comes into the play. Was there a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification? The answer to that is unequivocally no. Commander Allen provides Ruby the photographic array, and as I mentioned before, he didn't just stop after she identified him and said, that's him. He vetted her credibility.
Why was she acquitted? Well, is there some particularly good evidence presented by the defense, or did she withdraw her identification or not testify or what?
No, Your Honor, the identification was part of the evidence, and there's no single reason why. I mean, it's a high standard, Your Honor. It's beyond a reasonable doubt.
I thought that coat didn't turn out right, and that the shifting stories that Ruby told were brought out at the trial. And actually, I guess it was after the trial the DNA scrapings didn't match up, and there were all sorts of things that eventually came together. I have a question for you, though. Suppose to, and I'll just make it a hypothetical because I don't want to get too deeply into this case. Suppose somebody had been robbed and at the hospital someone says, your neighbor four houses down the road, Smith, was bragging to somebody that he'd robbed a currency exchange. And then the next day there's the photo array and you see Smith's face in that photo array. Wouldn't you be more likely to pick out Smith? Because somebody has said to you, you know, Smith was the one who did it. I know that's a little bit more simplified than the facts of this case, but I think that's the theory of undue influence, that the name comes out, that she sees the face, it's a face she knows, and she's just psychologically inclined to pick that face out of the group, as opposed to say, no, I really don't see anybody here, or anything like that.
To answer your question, Your Honor, yes, there is a chance that you're more likely going to pick the person that you know. However,
that you've been told, you know, there's some indirect triple-level hearsay, you know, that Smith was bragging about doing it. So you see the array the next day, and you see Smith's face, and you think, oh, yeah, you know, there, that guy.
Right, Your Honor, but since the test is objective, and you only look at the information coming to Commander Allen, then that's how you test whether Commander Allen had probable cause.
Right, but Commander Allen was there when the name was mentioned in the hospital room, and then he was the one who conducted the array. So I think we can attribute knowledge of the previous mentioning of the name to Commander Allen. He was standing right there.
Yes, Your Honor. But that doesn't mean that what happened was constitutionally impermissible. It's not according to the law, and that's black-letter law. And
well, I mean, I'm just saying, if there's a concern about the integrity of the identification procedure itself, then there's a problem relying on it, right?
Only, Your Honor, under the standard if there's a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification.
Mm-hmm.
So here the problem, or the potential problem, is that Ruby overheard the name Wydrick. Commander Allen tested that. Was there a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification? No, because she said, who's Wydrick Phillips? I don't know anybody that lives down 8 houses from my mother who looks like that. At that point, based on the information known to Allen, there is not a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. That's the key issue. Plaintiff is saying that Commander Allen had reason to believe that what Ruby's identification was suspicious. He did not. These supposed prior interactions that Ruby had with Wydrick, he didn't know about those. And with respect to anything that happened after, as Your Honors pointed out, that's completely irrelevant. This court has held that police are entitled to act based on the observable events. They don't have to, under this court's authority in Beauchamp versus City of Noblesville, plaintiff cited that case, Woods versus City of Chicago, Spiegel versus Cortez, Commander Allen didn't have to interview all available witnesses, search for more exculpatory evidence, investigate plaintiff's potential alibi, or continue his investigation at all. Probable cause doesn't even require more likely true than not true. It just requires one reliable, credible witness, and Commander Allen had that. But, Your Honor, even if there is a problem with the photographic array, which there was not, summary judgment should still be affirmed because Ruby's identification was reliable under the Biggers factors. We've addressed that before, but regarding the qualified immunity issue, plaintiff mentioned Beauchamp. In that case, qualified immunity was actually granted. A rape victim had identified her attacker, and the court held, yes, based on that identification, the police were allowed to act. They had qualified immunity. That was the law. Plaintiff is relying on this case in his oral argument. It's the same situation here, Your Honor. Commander Allen had a reliable identification from a victim of a crime, somebody who was actually there, and was allowed to act based on that. As a final point, plaintiff's Monell claim fails because there's no underlying constitutional violation, and for all these reasons, the decision of the District Court for the Northern District of Illinois should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Victor. Anything further, Mr. Crooks?
Yes, Your Honor.
The counsel has talked about one ID was sufficient, but each time he said that, he correctly added the modifier, one credible ID, one reliable ID. We believe under these circumstances we have a right to have a jury decide whether this is a credible or reliable ID. Qualified immunity.
But your real complaint is about Allen's being dishonest, right? I assume that's your malicious prosecution.
It certainly is our malicious prosecution.
I don't contend with that. I don't understand. If a perfectly good malicious prosecution case, why does it have to be converted into a federal case?
Because we feel that there is a federal case for false arrest here. And I'll tell you why. Counsel said it's a reasonably prudent officer, what he would know. But the cases say it's if that reasonably prudent officer knows everything Allen knows. Allen knows what he did. Allen knows he guided these victims to choose Wydrick Phillips so that he had someone he could put this case on. That is knowledge the reasonably prudent officer would have to consider. He knew that he was asking her to do this. She knew it. We know that because when they went to the hospital, when Allen went to the hospital and talked to Elizabeth, and she said, I can't identify anyone, he insisted that she look at the photos anyway. And sure enough, she picked out Wydrick. Why? Because she knew that the police were asking her to do that.
Do you think when she said she couldn't identify the attacker, you think it was wrong for him to say, well, take a look at this photo array. Maybe you can. Is that wrong? Is that misconduct?
I think where it became misconduct is where he...
Answer my question.
I think standing alone...
Okay.
I think standing alone, he may get by with that. But when he says...
He may get by with that. I don't agree with you. I think it's perfectly appropriate. The person says, no, I'd never be able to recognize him in a photograph. Right? And you say, well, look, take a look at these photos. Maybe it'll change your mind. What's wrong with that?
What clearly made it impermissible was for Allen to say the person
well,
that shot
clearly, you. Clearly, but I don't think it's impermissible to do that. I don't want a situation where police can't arrest anybody because of your insistence that they, you know, really have solid evidence before they can arrest someone who shot someone. I don't see that.
Your Honor, just a credible eyewitness that identifies, and I don't think we've got a credible one here. And Your Honor, probable cause does not change based upon the egregiousness of the offense. Probable cause is probable cause. And when we talk about...
I don't agree with you.
I understand, Your Honor.
Clearly, if you have some mass murderer at large, you're going to arrest more people, right? That's perfectly sensible. Do you think the Fourth Amendment is devoid of any sense? Right?
I'm aware of no case.
You arrest more people if you have a more dangerous person at large.
I've never seen a case that says
well,
there's a sliding scale, Your Honor.
What do you think of the common sense of that, right? What if you know that there's a mass murderer running around, and you don't know exactly who, you don't know who it is, and so you arrest more suspicion, you have to have some suspicion, you have something. You can't just arrest the people at random. But wouldn't it make sense to allow the arrest to be based on less evidence than if it were, you know, these crimes they're talking about in the New York Times, the girl who ate her sandwich in the supermarket, and the, right? Don't you want the police to discriminate among these different types of threat to public order?
Judge, my answer to that is very clear. Probable cause is probable cause. If an officer feels that the public is threatened by a particular person and he wants to take that step and arrest that person without probable cause to protect life, then he does it as his own peril.
Probable cause is the same thing whether you're investigating someone from shoplifting a sandwich or you're investigating someone for being a serial murderer. On a spree, you know, like that Washington shooter and so on. You think, doesn't matter, probable cause is the same, you know, no matter what the crime. That seems to me very wooden.
It's what I read the law as saying, Your Honor.
Well, the law hasn't actually confronted the issue, has it?
I have not seen...
You're referring to the sort of semantics of probable cause rather than actual cases which refuse to differentiate depending on the nature of the...
I've never even seen the argument made, Your Honor. And the only last comment I would make is that qualified immunity, all the cases have the phrase good faith. That's what qualified immunity is about, is protecting officers who act in good faith.
Yes.
The
Thank
evidence
you,
here is that there was no good faith. We'd ask for a reversal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement.